soldier to cook for him.
But Kenneth Yamamoto is only sharing one meal with us,
said Papa, shaking his head. She looked at Papa.
I will send him off with extra for his trip. I have used many of our ration coupons, though.
Papa winked at Ivy and pointed to the cake on the counter.
It is good for us, yes?
Ivy grinned and nodded. When Kenny arrived in his khaki uniform, he placed his officer's cap on a table by the door. His head was shaved, and it made his ears look much too big for his head. He spoke quietly and politely, calling Papa sir and Mama ma'am. He was far more serious than Ivy had expected, seeming much older than Fernando, even though there were only 2 years between them. At first, Ivy felt shy around him, but she found herself scooting her chair closer to his, listening to everything he said. He told about his time in Hawaii and how he had been reassigned to another ship.
My brother said he's going over soon, in the belly of a big plane, but we don't know where, said Ivy.
Can you keep a secret?
Ivy smiled and nodded.
I love secrets.
Sometimes.
Going over usually means the European theater, said Kenny. So he'll probably be in Italy or France or Germany. I'll be stationed in the same area, but on a ship.
As they lingered around the kitchen table, he and Papa did most of the talking. At first, the conversation was about the recent events on the farm, how Ivy had discovered the music room, and what had happened with Mr. Ward. Then, it became about the war, where it was heading and how long it might last.
Serious talk.
But when Papa got up to get more coffee and Mama was clearing dishes, Kenny reached over and pulled Ivy's braid, exactly as Fernando used to do. She didn't complain as she might have if it had been Fernando. Instead, she giggled. After lunch, Kenny said,
I'd like to go see my house now. Want to cut through the grove with me, Ivy? Your father told me that you have big plans. You can show me.
Papa looked at his watch.
I will pull the truck over to the house and meet you and Ivy there in a half hour. Then I'm afraid it will already be time to take you back to the bus station.
Mama smiled.
I will make some sandwiches with the leftovers.
Kenny stood and put on his hat.
Goodbye, Mrs. Lopez. Thank you for everything. I hope I will meet Fernando someday soon.
Mama became teary-eyed and opened her arms to hug him. Kenny looked surprised, but he hugged her back. Outside, as they walked through the orange grove, Kenny took a deep breath.
It's funny what you miss when you're away from home. I miss the smell of the orange trees, my mother's cooking, and my little sister's arguing over whose turn it is to be first for anything. And I miss wearing civilian clothes, like your jacket. Is that your brother's?
Fernando gave it to me until he comes home, so I would remember he is keeping me safe and warm, even from far away.
Kenny smiled.
I'm glad our families have decided to survive this war together, Ivy. I think we're more alike than different. Your father told me you signed up for orchestra.
Did you know I was in the orchestra too? And my sisters? They play flute. Mr. Daniels was our teacher. I played
the violin, said Ivy. I know, I saw a picture in your house.
Do you like Mr. Daniels?
He's my favorite teacher, said Ivy. I like how he talks. He told us we have to play majestically.
Kenny laughed.
That sounds like Mr. Daniels.
Kenny was easy to talk to, and before she knew it, Ivy found herself telling him about the first day of orchestra and how the boys had laughed at her because she was from Lincoln Annex and how Mr. Daniels had put a stop to it. She told him about playing When Johnny Comes Marching Home, how she hoped to play the flute and wished she could go to Lincoln, Maine.
Some of the parents are asking why the school district is paying for a music teacher during a war. But Mr. Daniel says everyone needs a little beauty and light in their lives, especially during the worst of times.
Kenny nodded.
Mr. Daniels is right. Can you play the harmonica for me?
I know you have it with you. He winked. Your father told me you carry it everywhere and play beautifully.
Papa had said that?
She blushed and pulled the harmonica from her pocket, but then hesitated. Kenny prodded and teased her, like Fernando would have.
Just one song. Please. I don't want to have to pull your braids again.
When he reached out and threatened, she laughed. Kenny didn't seem so grown up now. He just seemed like someone's big brother. Ivy played Auld Lang Syne and let herself fill up on the wondrous tone of her harmonica. Here, within the trees, it seemed as though time stood still. She closed her eyes, riding the notes until she was inside the song. She saw Kenny and Donald and Tom in the wagon, making a fort with crates, playing hide-and-seek and catch, and Susan taking piano lessons with Mrs. Yamamoto. Her mind drifted back to playing jacks with Araceli, jumping rope 100 times double dutch without missing, and seeing her in the doorway, wearing the purple hat and blowing kisses. She trilled the last note, making it sound like a piccolo. When she opened her eyes, Kenny was nodding his approval. Ivy could tell by the faraway look in his eyes that he had remembered things, too.
You have promised, Ivy. When I come home again, you will have learned the flute. Practice so I can come to a concert one day and sit in the audience while you perform on stage.
She smiled, warmed by his words. He made her feel like things were possible, just as Miss Delgado and Mr. Daniels had. She hoped that someday it would be true, that she'd be on stage in front of him, and that he'd be proud of her. Even though he was somebody else's brother, he felt like he belonged to her, at least for this afternoon. They came through the last row of trees to the Yamamoto's backyard. Ivy showed Kenny the shed and the seedlings and the war garden, and she told him her plans for the orange and vegetable stand.
Oranges for war bonds.
I like that, he said.
When Kenny saw the flag with the blue star hanging on the boards over the front door, where Papa stood waiting, Ivy saw his lip quiver. He strode over to Papa and clasped his hand and said,
I thank you for everything, and my father thanks you.
They signed the papers, which would bind their families forever, right on the hood of the truck. On the way to the bus station, they drove by Lincoln, Maine. Papa told him all about his efforts so Ivy could go there.
Sir, I hope the lawyer can do some good, said Kenny.
He is optimistic.
There was a case near San Diego in 1931, Roberto Alvarez versus the Lemon Grove School District, with the same circumstances.
The parents organized and they won, but only in a lower court. The lawyer says he can use this to plead the case, and the more parents who come forward to tell their children's stories, the better it will be for all children who follow. I am going to tell Ivy's story.
Kenny Yamamoto nodded.
That is good, sir. Everyone needs to fight for someone, on the battlefield or at home.
Papa pulled up to the bus terminal and turned off the motor. Kenny turned to Papa.
Mr. Lopez, sir, I've been thinking about what I might send to my family that could be of some comfort to them in the internment camp. Something that won't be too difficult to bring back home with them someday.
Would you mind packaging and sending my sister's flutes? They're in that music room you discovered and have their names on them.
Of course, said Papa.
He looked at Ivy and winked.
Everyone needs a little beauty and light, especially during the worst of times, right?
She smiled.
What about you?
He shook his head. I can't very well carry a violin on the battlefield.
Ivy pulled the harmonica from her pocket and turned it in her hands, running her fingers over the shiny cover plate with its beautiful engravings and the mysterious letter M. She was overcome with a feeling of wanting to help Kenny. Impulsively, before he could climb down from the cab, Ivy grabbed his hand, pressed the harmonica into it, and closed his fingers around it. He looked at it and then at her.
Are you sure?
Ivy nodded.
I promise. I'll bring it back to you someday.
Kenny slipped it into the chest pocket of his uniform, climbed down from the cab, and closed the truck door. Then he stepped forward so he could see Ivy and Papa through the windshield and saluted. Ivy saluted back and whispered,
I know.
Chapter 21.
I'm finished. What about you?
Called Ivy. Susan's head popped up from where she was working on a sign for Mrs. Yamamoto's stand. All morning they had weeded around it, swept out spiderwebs, and each painted a piece of plywood to lean against either side of the stand so cars might see their message coming from either direction. Since Papa signed the agreement with Kenny Yamamoto 6 weeks ago, a huge wave of relief seemed to have washed over all of them. Mama and Papa still clung to the belief that the war would end soon. Fernando's letters had been arriving in batches. They might not hear from him for 2 weeks, but then they would get 4 letters in 1 mail delivery, all filled with questions and excitement about the new home. Ivy received 1 letter from Araceli. She and her family were moving to another state. Ivy had written her back, but hadn't received another letter in return. Somehow, she knew she might not ever hear from Araceli again. Even so, if they were lucky enough to meet once more, Ivy knew they'd pick up where they'd left off, as best friends. Orchestra had started in earnest, and Mr. Daniel's prediction had come true. Ivy had fallen in love with the flute. He called Ivy his star pupil, and said the only student who had ever come close to her ability was Karen Yamamoto. Ivy couldn't wait to meet her someday. Ivy ran around to see Susan's sign.
It's perfect.
Coming soon, oranges for war bonds, 10 cents a bag or 1 war stamp. God bless America.
When do you think we can start selling? Asked Susan.
Papa said the oranges are ready by the 1st of March, so next week. Later we'll do vegetables.
I'm glad your dad said you can help.
He said anything for the war effort that will bring our boys home sooner. He's even going to give us some of the vegetables from our garden.
Zucchini for war bonds, said Susan.
Green beans for war bonds, giggled Ivy.
Asparagus for...
The boy on the bicycle rode past them, his white shirt sleeves rolled up, his blue pants tied at the ankles with string, as usual. He wore the same blue cap with an emblem and carried the same pouch slung across his chest. Ivy waved, but he was pedaling quickly and didn't respond.
He never waves back, she complained to Susan.
But Susan didn't answer, and the color had drained from her face.
Susan, what is it?
The boy. Susan looked as if she might faint. Ivy pulled her to the bench and sat down next to her.
You know who he is?
Ivy, everyone knows who he is.
Susan's eyes were big pools of green. She looked down the road.
Did he turn at the crossroad or go straight?
Straight, I think.
Why does it matter? Asked Ivy.
Remember I told you how we found out that Donald was killed?
Yes, a telegram, right?
Susan nodded.
It was brought to our house by a Western Union messenger. That boy on the bicycle.
Susan's hands began to tremble.
Which way was he riding? Did he turn toward my house?
No, Ivy said. He turned toward mine.
She shivered and grabbed Fernando's jacket from where she tossed it. Her head filled with a loud buzzing. Were there bees nearby? And then she heard music. The Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Ivy stood. At first, she walked up the Yamamoto's drive and then ran. She cut through the grove and wove around the trees, oranges thudding to the ground as she knocked into them. Her feet and heart pounded. She could hear Susan behind her.
Ivy! Ivy!
He's trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored.
Ivy ran so fast she felt dizzy. Still, the music played on. When she reached the edge of the grove, she had to stop and bend over to catch her breath. She grabbed her side.
He has loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword.
Susan came up behind her and put an arm around Ivy's waist. They took a few steps forward together, past the last of the trees, until Ivy's house came into view. The bicycle leaned against the porch, and the boy stood at their door.
His truth is marching on.
Part 4. April 1951, New York City, New York, USA. Some Enchanted Evening. Music by Richard Rodgers. Lyrics by Oscar Hammerstein II.
Some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger. You may see a stranger across a crowded room. And somehow you know, you'll know even then, that somewhere you'll see him again and again.
Chapter 1. On an evening embroidered with a thread of destiny, in a theater crowned with a halo of light, Friedrich Schmidt escorted Father and Uncle Gunther to the best in the house seats. Friedrich's eyes swept to the tiered boxes, dress circle, and upper balconies, their facades intricately carved with laurels and painted gold. He'd been told the concert was sold out, but he still couldn't imagine every seat filled with concertgoers.
"You two don't mind waiting?"
In awe, Father waved his arm in an arc.
"We will sit here and admire all this majesty."
"We wanted to be early," said Uncle Gunther, "to see the evening unfold, beginning to end. It is quite an honor to be seated by the conductor himself. It is a long road you have traveled, Friedrich."
"We have traveled, Uncle, together. After all, who taught me to ride a bicycle and play the harmonica?"
Uncle Gunther laughed and winked.
"I did. You're a sweet boy to remember."
"And who was my first and most accomplished teacher?"
He squeezed Father's shoulder. Father smiled at him.
"Thank you, son."
Uncle Gunther tugged at his collar where the silk tie he wore was knotted. His suit was a far cry from their factory overalls.
"You know I only wear a tie for a few occasions, but your concerts are always worth the trouble."
In recent years, Father and Uncle Gunther had attended many concerts where he had conducted, but tonight was a pinnacle debut. Friedrich perched on the arm of Father's seat, as impressed as they were with this moment and the miraculous journey that had taken them from Trossingen to Bern and ultimately here to Carnegie Hall in New York City to conduct the Empire Philharmonic. Tchaikovsky had conducted his own compositions on the hall's first opening night. The Tchaikovsky. Friedrich could hardly believe he'd stand on the same stage. As if feeling his thoughts, Father said,
"They say that all the musicians who have performed here have left a wisp of their spirits behind."
Friedrich nodded. People talked about the undeniable energy in the building. How could he harness it?
"Do you think Tchaikovsky was as nervous as I am?"
Father shook a finger at him.
"Of course, and I would say the same thing to him. You have as much right to be on that stage as the next conductor."
Just put one foot in front of the other and look up.
Friedrich patted Father's shoulder and smiled.
I'll remember.
On stage, the musicians' chairs sat empty in several large semicircles, waiting. A concert grand piano guarded the left of the stage. Father put a hand on Friedrich's.
It is difficult to believe we are here. It seems like yesterday we were in Trossingen. I only wish...
I know, Father, whispered Friedrich.
I miss her too.
Friedrich knew Father still held out hope that he would one day see Elizabeth again. He'd never stopped writing to her, so she wouldn't forget the sound of his voice. Not during the war, when she had remained a devoted nurse, even caring for soldiers in a prisoner of war camp, or in the years following, when she worked in a pediatric hospital in eastern Berlin. Friedrich wrote, too, especially when the opportunity to move to America was arranged. He had begged her to join him and Father and Uncle Gunther for a chance at a new life in a new country. She refused, saying she'd found her true calling. Still, Friedrich couldn't help but continue to hope that he, like his brave imaginary friend Hansel, could one day lead his sister home to their father, and that someday they'd all be together once more. Friedrich often wondered what might have happened to them if Elizabeth hadn't sent the Reichsmarks for Father's ransom. Father was right. It didn't feel like 18 years had passed since that fateful day on the train heading to Dachau. The engine had already started to chuff. Friedrich had heard the music to Tchaikovsky's Sleeping Beauty waltz and pretended to conduct, infuriating the two officers, Eiffel and Faber. As they tried to march him off the train, calling Friedrich a lunatic and promising to lock him away, the whistle blew, long and insistent. The train lurched forward and began to move. Eiffel and Faber shoved him aside, scrambled to the door, and leaped to the platform as the train tick-tick-ticked over the rails, leaving them far behind. Uncle Gunther had been right about the holidays. More people were traveling. The trains were crowded. Everyone held packages and seemed more preoccupied with the season than with a self-conscious boy gripping his father's future on his way to Dachau. After the commandant listened to Friedrich's appeal and examined the box of cookies, he accepted the package and sent for Father. Friedrich tried not to look alarmed when he saw him. In a little over a month, Father had gone from energetic and strong to weak and frail. He dragged one leg. He seemed disoriented. Friedrich helped him from the camp, walking and resting every few minutes until they reached the first farm, where Friedrich borrowed a goat cart and pulled Father to Munich, to the home of Uncle Gunther's friend, the doctor. It took weeks for Father to recuperate enough to begin their journey to Switzerland. Father refused to talk about what had happened to him at the camp, insisting that it was nothing compared to what was done to others, and becoming tearful and adamant that he was one of the fortunate. After a while, Friedrich stopped asking. Uncle Gunther was waiting for them in Bern. He and Friedrich took jobs in a Swiss chocolate factory. Father gave cello lessons. Eventually, Friedrich applied to the Bern Conservatory. One path led to another. It was strange how on such an auspicious occasion as tonight, in one of the most famous venues in the world, Friedrich's thoughts kept wandering back to his beginnings. He looked down at his father and uncle, who by some miracle were at his side, safe and healthy. And instead of the concert before him, Friedrich flashed back to his happiest childhood memories of Friday night get-togethers in the parlor with Elizabeth at the piano, Uncle Gunther on his accordion, Father on cello, and Friedrich on harmonica, their polkas accompanied by the occasional rally from the cuckoo clock in the hall. Musicians began to appear on the grand stage. Dressed in black, they took their chairs, adjusted their music stands, and opened the scores. The wind instruments ran the scale to warm the pipes. The violins mewled and purred, Friedrich stood. I should go. He smiled at Father and Uncle Gunther and headed toward the side stage door. Before he opened it, he glanced back at the house. Father and Uncle Gunther looked small amid the field of red velvet seats. Father sat straight and tall, studying his program. Friedrich could feel his pride, even from a distance. The ushers opened the lobby doors, and people began to filter inside. Friedrich fled backstage, stepping up to the wing and leaning against the wall. He closed his eyes and concentrated on the concert, a portrait of stage and film. He smiled. Musicals and movies were such an American fondness, and he admitted he liked them too. He replayed the program in his mind, the first half dedicated to George and Ira Gershwin, starting with Porgy and Bess, a symphonic picture, orchestration by Robert Russell Bennett, with the main songs from the opera. Friedrich loved the orchestral classical composition. It would be followed by Rhapsody in Blue, with a featured piano soloist. After intermission, he would conduct the South Pacific Suite, music and lyrics by Rodgers and Hammerstein. It was the most popular musical in the city right now, and a coveted ticket on Broadway. The baritone, Robert Merrill, would perform selected songs from the musical, closing with Some Enchanted Evening. There were rumors that the composer and librettist, Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein, friends of Robert Merrill, would be in the audience. Friedrich closed his eyes, and his hands went through the motions of conducting the first overture. For a moment, he stopped and looked around before starting again, his memories so deeply set that he couldn't help but remember the school bench where he'd once been bullied for conducting an imaginary orchestra. But here, everyone was focused on becoming one voice. They all spoke the same language and had found their way to this night with their own stories of determination and practice and their love for music. Here he was safe. The stage manager nodded to Friedrich. The musicians were in position. The concertmaster stood and lifted his violin, playing the A. On stage, the violins hummed in response. The cellos and basses moaned softly. Chords filled the room as the musicians checked the tuning of their instruments. The oboe sounded, and the wind instruments matched it. Friedrich searched out the new flutist. She'd seemed nervous in rehearsals, so he'd taken time to talk with her. She was one of the youngest players he'd ever encountered in a symphony orchestra, but supremely talented. There was something intense and purposeful about how she played, a feeling he couldn't quite pinpoint, but at the same time understood. Her eagerness to embrace the music and surrender to it reminded him somehow of himself. Bit by bit, the sounds dwindled, the hall hushed. When the house lights dimmed, a smattering of clapping erupted. The stage manager pointed at Friedrich. Although he'd long come to terms with the birthmark on his face, and even refused the heavy stage makeup that some managers offered him, Friedrich still hesitated for a few seconds in the wing, wanting and dreading the walk on stage. Every performance in front of an audience was always a journey fraught with the unknown. He whispered the good luck phrase he always said before he headed to the conductor's podium, the same words he'd whispered to his harmonica that day that he'd polished it and sent it out into the world. Gute Reise. Safe travels. He strode on stage and was met by a wave of applause. Friedrich picked up his baton and raised his arms, poised to give a slight flick of the wrist to the percussionists. Four long chimes, like stepping stones to another world, rang out. Friedrich slipped into the opera story, the music filling him with the emotion of Porgy's plight, much of it resonating in his own heart. A lonely man with a crippled body, a bully who thought he could rule the world. An ever-present evil, the loss of a loved one to something beyond his control, and what seemed an insurmountable challenge. Friedrich moved the orchestra into the tender song, Summertime, and anticipated the rising emotion in the music. He imagined the lyrics,
Hush, little baby. Don't you cry. The music was bigger than Friedrich, overpoweringly beautiful, euphoric, and true. He was swept inside it. The orchestra was with him, and he with them. This was what he had craved as a young boy when he imagined himself on the top rung of the A-frame ladder on the factory floor, two stories high, and directing an imaginary symphony. A magnificent sound from a union of many, a story that came alive through the playing. He brought the orchestra to a crescendo and a final emphatic finish. When the music stopped, Friedrich held his breath and waited. There was always a moment after the last sounds and before the ovation, an elegant pause that Friedrich cherished. It was a pure space filled with one question. Had the audience listened with its heart?
Chapter 2. As the taxi pulled up to the corner of 57th Street and 7th Avenue in New York City, Mike Flannery rushed from the lobby of the theater where he'd been waiting and pacing in his tuxedo. The back door opened, and Frankie jumped out, running to Mike and hugging him.
Look at you! Carnegie Hall, just like we said! Are the balconies all gold and the seats all red?
Mike laughed and patted Frankie on the back. It's as if you're standing inside an ornate golden egg. And yes, the seats are just like Granny said they'd be. He held Frankie at arm's length, admiring his suit.
You don't look so bad yourself. Your first year of law school is agreeing with you. Top of the class so far, he said, standing taller.
Guess what? We're going to eat roasted beef and ice cream after, for old time's sake.
Or for new time's sake.
Someone made reservations at the Russian Tea Room. Frankie nodded toward the taxi, grinning. Mr. Howard helped Aunt Eunie from the back seat. She looked elegant in her long black dress and gray fox stole.
I made the reservations, she said, pulling Mike into a hug.
Thank you, Auntie, said Mike, kissing her on the cheek. It had become his endearment for her, and she insisted it suited her far better than the much-too-formal Aunt Eunie.
Mr. and Mrs. Potter sent you their best, she said.
How are they?
Asked Mike.
Happy as clams in Atlantic City with their daughter and grandchildren. As much as I miss them, retirement is agreeing with them.
After Mr. Howard paid for the taxi, he embraced Mike too.
We're so proud of you, Mike. How have the rehearsals gone?
They've gone well, I think. I like the conductor, Friedrich Schmidt, very much. By the way, he is looking for a lawyer to help him finalize some paperwork for his father and uncle. I overheard him talking in the green room, and I recommended your firm. He's interested in speaking with you. I can introduce you backstage after the concert.
It will be my pleasure, and I'll offer him assistance pro bono.
Frankie leaned in.
That means without charge, for the public good.
Mike rolled his eyes.
I know.
He looked at Mr. Howard. Is he becoming insufferable?
Only on occasion.
He put his arms around Mike and Frankie, pulling them close.
Oh, it's so good to have all of us together again.
Mike led them inside and handed them off to an usher.
I have to go now.
He winked at Auntie. I'm looking forward to the roasted beef and ice cream.
And cake,
she said, smiling. He kissed her cheek again.
Auntie, I'd never be here without you.
She straightened the lapel of his jacket.
We helped each other, didn't we? But I think I received the best part of our arrangement. Two fine boys.
Mike blinked back tears. Granny had known it in her soul. The right person had found them. Frankie leaned toward Mike and held out an upright fist.
You and me, we stick together.
Mike did the same, tapping Frankie's.
That's right, kid. You and me.
In his dressing room, Mike waited for his call. It was funny how Frankie's words could rekindle his childhood memories.
Granny telling them all about Carnegie Hall, the cellar at Bishop's, and the night he and Frankie tried to run away. It turned out that all those years ago, he'd been wrong about Auntie. She had wanted them. Mike had been mistaken about the papers he'd seen on her desk. The appeal for the reversal of their adoptions had been approved and the papers sent to her, but they wouldn't become legal unless she signed them, which she never intended to do. When Mike had confronted her that day in the library, his love for Frankie had shined a light on her heart. She ceremoniously burned the papers in the fireplace the day after Mike's fall from the tree, when by some grace, nothing more than the wind was knocked out of him. Mike, Frankie, Mr. and Mrs. Potter, Auntie and Mr. Howard, they never called him anything other than Mr. Howard, even after he and Auntie married, moved to his house on the corner. The best, not the worst, had happened to him and Frankie. Mike was invited to join Hoxie's band, and he did for 1 year. Mr. Potter had been overjoyed and continued to be his coach. Then, as the piano consumed Mike's interest and time, he began to think about leaving the band. One day, a representative from the Women's Auxiliary gave an impassioned plea for old instruments that could be sent to poor children who might otherwise never have a chance at music. Mike felt strangely compelled, as if he should pass his harmonica along, as if someone were waiting for it. So he gave it up, sending it on a journey to another child who needed the world to seem brighter with more possibilities, and wanted to testify to feelings in his or her heart, just as Mike had. By the time Frankie was old enough to join, the famous Philadelphia harmonica band of wizards had dissolved due to lack of funds. Frankie didn't mind, because by then he hoped to be a cowboy and was saving Ralston Purina cereal box tops for a series of Tom Mix comic books. After high school, Mike was admitted to Juilliard School of Music in New York City. Before he could enter, the U.S. government lowered the draft age to 18. America was at war, and Mike entered the U.S. Army. After his tour of duty, he finally went to Juilliard and then auditioned for the Philadelphia Philharmonic. A few years later, he moved to New York City, the place he always dreamed he would belong. There was a knock on the private dressing room door. A voice from the other side said,
"Mr. Flannery, 5 minutes, sir."
"Thank you,"
called Mike, taking a deep breath. He headed toward the stage, catching the eye of the stage manager who waved him over to the wing.
"About 3 minutes until your solo."
Mike heard the last lines of the Porgy and Bess suite and the thunderous applause that followed. Friedrich Schmidt walked off the stage to the wing where Mike stood waiting. "Ready?" he asked, smiling. Mike nodded.
"Ready."
Friedrich waited until the orchestra had regrouped and turned the pages of their music before walking back on stage. Mike followed and sat at the piano. Friedrich raised his baton. Mike heard the clarinet glissando that opened Rhapsody in Blue. He waited for the horns and strings and the rest of the orchestra to fan out around him. He stretched his fingers and held them over the keys as he had once done in Granny's parlor and in the music room on Amaryllis Drive, feeling the all-too-familiar attraction to play and perform. He waited for the crescendo and began. While he played, he thought about how Gershwin had composed much of the piece on a train, with the rattling and jiggling and clacking over the rails. Gershwin heard music in the midst of noise and saw the piece as an array of all that was American, a composition of people of every color, rich and poor, quiet and loud, a mishmash of humanity. Mike played it as if he were in Granny's neighborhood, with girls playing hopscotch and boys playing pimpleball, and cars and trucks honking and mothers hollering out their windows for their children. At the tender interval before the finale, he heard his mother humming and saw Granny throwing open the window so the entire neighborhood could hear the beauty of his playing. The music sauntered through Central Park, strolled through boroughs, tiptoed across bridges,
waltzed in ballrooms. Ran. The Big Apple. His city. The place he'd always wanted to be. The place Granny had loved and always wanted to take him. Was he really here on this stage? He pounded out the rhythms of sledgehammers and the staccato riveters as the city grew upward, scraping the sky. He followed the music, but his heart was following his journey to this very spot in time. From Allentown to Philly to Bishop's and his and Frankie's promises to stick together. From Bishop's to Amaryllis Drive and learning to hope for the best. And that no matter how much sadness there is in life, there are equal amounts of maybe things will get better someday soon. From Hoxie's Philadelphia Harmonica Band to the U.S. Army to Juilliard to this piano bench in Carnegie Hall where, for one moment, with any luck, the audience's heart and the world would stand still. The conductor wrapped the orchestra around him, and together they brought the audience to their feet. Mike slid from the piano bench, took a breath, and bowed as the applause embraced him. Above all the cheers, he heard Frankie calling out,
"Bravo! Bravo!"
Chapter 3. Backstage, during intermission in the green room, Ivy looked in the mirror and smiled at herself with relief. She had made it through the first half of her concert debut with this orchestra. If only Fernando could have been here to walk her to the theater, like the many times he had walked her to her first day of school, she might not have been so nervous. Beforehand, she'd straightened her dress a dozen times, and worried so much about her hair that she'd finally pulled it back, straight and sleek, and tied it with a black ribbon at the nape of her neck so it wouldn't interfere with her playing. Even though she was only a fourth chair flutist, she was still the youngest member of the symphony orchestra. Everyone had been kind and supportive, and the conductor himself had taken her under his wing. She wished Mama and Papa could be here tonight. With the travel time by train, though, it was too long for Papa to leave the farm, and Fernando needed Mama right now. They all sent Ivy flowers and their love. As much as Papa had come around to appreciating Ivy's gift for the flute, it had still taken Fernando to convince him to let Ivy pursue a career in music. Papa couldn't figure out how Ivy might support herself, but Fernando had persisted. He said it was a great honor to have a musician in the family. He said that when Ivy played, it made people happy and helped them forget their troubles for a short time. He told Papa that without music, it would be a sad world. And he would have given anything to hear something as beautiful as an orchestra playing when he lay on the battlefield, not knowing whether he would live or die or ever see his family again. All those years ago, the boy on the bicycle stood at their door and delivered a telegram. Fernando had been wounded in action while rescuing a fellow soldier in a minefield and lost two fingers in the explosions. He was discharged from the army with honors for his bravery. He came home to Orange County to put down roots and married Irma Alapisco, the third grade teacher at Lincoln Annex, which in 1945, due to the hard work and perseverance of parents, had been combined into one school with Lincoln, Maine. Fernando and Irma were due to have their first baby any day. Ivy smiled thinking about her family and friends in Orange County and the different paths all of their lives had taken. She had come to the Empire Philharmonic in New York on an exchange program with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Her best friend, Susan Ward, had become a legal secretary. Tom, Susan's brother, had been the only one of the boys from the three families to come through the war without injury, and now managed his father's farms. The Yamamotos came home and resumed their lives, tending to their farm with the same loving care they had before the war. Over time, Karen and Annie also became Ivy's best friends. And thankfully, Kenny had survived the war too. Just barely.
He was on furlough now, before his next tour of duty in South Korea, and was in the audience tonight. All those years ago, she had promised him a concert someday. Neither of them could have imagined it would be here, in New York City, at Carnegie Hall. Before intermission, Ivy had been too nervous to search the audience for him. But now, as she walked back on stage and settled in her chair, she let her eyes scan the house before the lights went down. Kenny was easy to spot in his blue dress uniform. He was studying his program, then glanced up, caught her eye, and grinned. She blushed and her heart swelled when she thought of all the things he had done for her and her family. Deeding Papa the land and house after the war, finding her a master flute teacher, helping Fernando find a job as an electrician. She picked up her new flute, a recent gift from Kenny. She had argued it was too grand a gift, but he'd insisted it was long overdue. First, because he'd promised that day at the train station to someday return the harmonica to her, and never did. He now kept it, and his purple heart, in the box with his father's World War I war medals. And second, because she'd saved his life. That wasn't exactly true, but she supposed if she'd never given him the harmonica, he might not be alive today. Everyone said it was a miracle. Some called it an act of God. Others said the stars had aligned in his favor and it just wasn't his time to die. Even those who thought it was nothing more than a lucky coincidence were impressed and wanted to shake Kenny's hand so that some of his good fortune would rub off on them. By now, Ivy had heard the story so many times she could recite it. Oddly, she never tired of hearing the mysterious tale. Since the day she had put it into his hand, Ivy's harmonica had become Kenny's own personal good luck charm. He carried it in his left chest pocket, much in the way other soldiers carried a rabbit's foot or a religious medal. It was as much a part of his uniform as the dog tags he was required to wear around his neck. Kenny had been on a routine patrol in a heavily wooded area when his unit was ambushed. The zipping and zinging of bullets rang in his ears. He felt the sting in his leg and blood trickling down into his boot. But it was his chest he gripped before he collapsed to the ground. He looked up into the pines above him. The world went white, and then black. He woke in an old warehouse, converted to a German prisoner of war camp, in the hospital wing, his leg worse than he imagined. Three young women fussed over him as he drifted in and out of delirium. His fever soared and they mopped his brow. During moments of lucidity, he watched them straighten his sheets and sit at his side, leaning toward him, expectant. And he heard them whispering, "Live. You must live." As he languished, they read him stories from an ancient book. Stories about castles and banished babies, a witch, an exceptional boy, orphans, and a girl running through an orange grove. In his darkest hour, when it looked as if he might die, they sang to him. Their voices were beautiful and otherworldly, and they filled him with joy and determination. Their songs seemed to plead with him to carry on, as if they were begging for their own lives, as well as for his. One night, he took a turn for the better. His fever broke, and he woke hungry. Moonlight streamed through the open yet barred window next to his bed, spilling slats of light on the floor. He smiled at the three women, who had never left his side. They smiled in return, nodded in unison, and held hands. But before he could utter a word, they swirled from the room, into the night, disappearing into another time and place. In the morning, he asked his German nurse, Elizabeth, about the three women. He'd like to tell them thank you. Where had they gone? Had they been volunteers? Would they be back? She insisted he'd had no visitors. She told him the medicine he'd been taking could cause hallucinations. Soldiers saw all sorts of strange things in the hospital. Hadn't he mentioned a mother and two sisters back home? Perhaps he had been dreaming of them. She patted his hand and said it had all been in his mind.
She encouraged him to talk about his real family in the United States. He found himself telling her how he used to play the violin, about his sisters who played the flute, and the story of the room behind the closet where his father had hidden 3 pianos and dozens of other musical instruments. Elizabeth told him that her father had once played cello with the Berlin Philharmonic, and that her little brother was an accomplished musician, the finest she'd ever heard, who would have auditioned for the conservatory in Germany had circumstances been different. Kenny had smiled. He thought it sweet that she was so proud of her brother. During his stay in the hospital wing, Kenny became a celebrity. Prisoners, mostly French and American, and even the German guards, came to his bedside and asked to see the talisman that had saved his life. Kenny always obliged, taking it from his pocket. He cradled it in the palm of his hand and held it out for all to see. No matter how many times he showed it, he was still amazed by the miracle of the mangled harmonica that had trapped the deadly bullet meant for his heart. Ivy adjusted the pages of her music. Although she had enjoyed the Porgy and Bess Suite and Rhapsody in Blue, it was the Rodgers and Hammerstein South Pacific music she had waited for all night. She'd already seen the musical twice. Once, when she'd first moved to New York City a year ago, and last night, with Kenny. The conductor, Friedrich Schmidt, walked on stage, followed by the pianist, Michael Flannery, who would join the orchestra for the second half with a solo in the finale. Next came the baritone from the Metropolitan Opera, Robert Merrill, also in black tuxedo and tails, who bowed and took a seat near the conductor. The audience applauded with anticipation. The sweeping South Pacific overture began. Ivy felt the story speak to her all over again, taking her on its journey. It was a brave production about discrimination and injustice. A woman in love with a man who had mixed-race children and her struggle to accept them. A soldier in love with a beautiful Tonkinese woman and his conflict over what his family back home might think if he were to marry her. It was a story framed by intolerance and war, themes all too familiar to her. The overture was followed by Robert Merrill singing My Girl Back Home, Younger Than Springtime, You've Gotta Be Carefully Taught, and This Nearly Was Mine. After each song, the audience was jubilant. An undeniable energy was building in the hall. Friedrich Schmidt raised his baton again. Robert Merrill stood poised to sing. On the downbeat, Michael Flannery began a piano prelude, his own piano solo arrangement of Some Enchanted Evening. At first, he played slowly, like a lullaby, then louder, like a storm, until the end of the verse, when he made it calm again. The conductor cued the orchestra. Robert Merrill began to sing Some Enchanted Evening. Ivy breathed into her flute and surrendered to the song, its tender, heart-rending proclamation of love bringing tears to her eyes.
Some enchanted evening, when you find your true love, when you feel her call you across a crowded room, then fly to her side and make her your own. Or all through your life you may dream all alone.
Ivy felt as if she'd been touched by magic. Her eyes caught the glances of other musicians, and it was clear they felt it too.
Who can explain it? Who can tell you why? Fools give you reasons, wise men never try. Some enchanted evening,
tonight, there was a brilliance in the hall, a communion of spirits, as if Ivy and the conductor and the pianist and the orchestra and everyone in the audience were one, breathing in and out to the same tempo, feeling one another's strength and vision, filling with beauty and light, glowing beneath the same stars, and connected by the same silken thread.
Once you have found her, never let her go. Once you have found her, never let her go.
Ten years after he was lost in a dark forest and found in a pear orchard, Otto married Mathilde. After all, she had always believed in him. It took many years, but finally they had a baby named Anneliese, who was born crippled. When it became clear she would never walk without difficulty, the local doctor recommended that Otto and Mathilde confine her in an asylum with other unfortunates. But they could not bear the idea. They tried every potion and poultice and sought out one doctor after another. Soon Otto was in debt. He was forced to sell their small cottage in the country and move his family into an apartment in the village. He took a job as a tuner in a shop where musical instruments were made. Over the years he had somehow acquired the ability to detect perfect pitch, and customers began to ask for only him. Soon his employer became jealous of his talent and notoriety and dismissed Otto from the shop. With no job, a sick daughter, and a wife who deserved better, Otto became despondent, often wandering the streets of the village before dawn, worrying. One morning, he saw a notice in a shop window. The great harmonica factory in Trosingen was seeking craftsmen who could produce high-quality mouth harps. Makers could submit a sample for consideration on a given day. Could this be his chance? Was he even capable? He had to try. Otto worked day and night at the kitchen table, making a model, sanding the pearwood comb, stamping the reed plate, and meticulously tuning the instrument to match the sound of the harmonica he so loved, the one that Eins, Zwei, and Drei had baptized with their breath all those years ago. A week later, he wrapped the instrument in a tea towel, put it in his pocket, and left by horse and wagon for the factory town. When he arrived, men from all over the region had already lined up with their harmonicas. Otto felt his stomach sink. How would he be judged against so many able craftsmen? The owner of the harmonica factory was particular, and Otto watched with dismay as most of the instruments were refused and the makers turned away. More than once he noticed men blotting tears because their work had not measured up to the owner's standards. He prepared his harp for disappointment. But when the owner examined and played Otto's harmonica, not only was he astounded by the quality and the tone, he placed a special order.
"I need 13, one for each of the managers of my departments, so they too might hear and appreciate this excellence. If you can deliver all of them within the month, and your harmonicas are as superior as I've seen and heard today, I would like to set up a shop for you in your village."
Otto was overjoyed. He would be able to honor his debts. He might buy back his cottage. But most of all, he and Mathilde would be able to care for their precious Anneliese. Otto rode home happy and determined. The evening before Otto was to deliver the order, he sat at the kitchen table, assembling the last of the instruments. The house was quiet and the hour was late. His wife had retired long ago. his beautiful daughter slept on a cot next to him. The dog snored at his feet. After he polished the cover plate, he sank into an exhausted sleep, slumping over his workspace and knocking the instrument to the floor. In the morning, he was preparing for his departure when he realized he could not find the 13th harmonica. He called to his wife for help. Together they searched the house. Minutes later, she stood before him, holding a chewed and ruined instrument. "The dog!" Otto was seized with desperation. "I must deliver 13! There is no time to make another!" He paced and fretted until his eyes landed on the harmonica Eins, Zwei, und Drei had once played, the one against which he measured the look and sound of all others. Could he part with it? He picked it up and turned it in his hand. He imagined the three sisters within the tree circle, opening the book each time the sun rose to see if more of their story had been written. At that moment, as if echoing Otto's memory, the sun rose outside his window. The harmonica glimmered in his hand. Morning church bells pealed. Was it all a sign? Otto looked at his wife, who now held his daughter. Anneliese wriggled from her mother's arms and limped toward him.
"Papa, can you play me a song, please?"
Otto's heart swelled with love for his family and gratitude for the promising future that spread before him. He played the harmonica one last time, hearing birdsong, a brook trickling over smooth stones, and the yodel of the wind through hollow logs. He thought about the others in front of him, the people he would never meet, who needed the harmonica, and the one whose life must someday be saved. He imagined Eins, Zwei, und Drei's reunion with their mother and brother somewhere in time, and he knew that what they'd once told him was true. The three sisters, Otto, and all the players who would one day breathe in and out of this unusual instrument were joined by the silken thread of destiny. It was time to pass the mouth harp to another. With a tiny brush, he tilted the harmonica and drew a small red M on one side of the pearwood. M for messenger. At the precarious instant when Kenny Yamamoto lived instead of died, the witch's spell broke, and doubt was eclipsed by enchantment once more. The three sisters found themselves with the midwife at the tumble-down cottage deep in the forest, where everything from table to teacup had reappeared, except for the witch, who was never seen again. With the midwife leading the way, the three sisters fled the dark forest, like the little birds that so easily took wing, each in turn carrying the book that had finally been written. The 13th harmonica of Otto Messenger. Forever after, Arabella, Rosita, and Wilhelmina lived in a safe and cozy castle with their family, who loved them and called them by name. When their happiness overflowed, as it often did, they sang, their voices blending so magically that people in the kingdom often stopped to listen and marvel at their gifts. And every night, as they lay in their beds, wondering what joy tomorrow might bring, yet knowing how precarious life can be, they repeated the words, "Your fate is not yet sealed."
even in the darkest night, a star will shine. A bell will chime. A path will be revealed.
This is David DeVries. We hope that you have enjoyed this production of Echo by Pam Munoz-Ryan. Otto's story and the fairy tale were read by Mark Bramhall. Friedrich's story was read by David DeVries. Mike's story was read by McLeod Andrews, and Ivy's story was read by Rebecca Soler. Musical arrangements and harmonica solos by Corky Siegel. Additional piano performed by Chi Shren Yang. Brahms' Lullaby for Cello, performed by Joycelyn Butler Shoulders. Some Enchanted Evening, arranged and produced by S. Pisnestades, and sung by Darren Chase. This program was produced at Dion Audio and directed by Sebastian Zetten. Executive producer, Paul R. Gagne. Editing and sound design by Jorge Reyes. Print edition published by Scholastic Press, an imprint of Scholastic Inc. Text copyright 2015 by Pam Munoz-Ryan. Some Enchanted Evening by Richard Rogers and Oscar Hammerstein II. Copyright 1949 by Williamson Music, ASCAP, an Imagim company, owner of publication and allied rights throughout the world. Copyright renewed. International copyright secured. All rights reserved, used by permission. Production copyright 2015 by Scholastic Inc. All rights reserved.
Some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger, you may see a stranger across a crowded room, and somehow you know even then, that somewhere you see her. Enchanted evening, someone may be laughing, you may hear laughing across a crowded room, and night after night, as strange as it seems, the sound of her laughter will sing in your dreams. Can explain it, who can tell you why? Fools give you reasons, wise men never try. Some enchanted evening, when you find your true love, when you feel her call you across a crowded room, then fly to her side. Make her your own, or through your life you may dream all alone. Once you have found her, never let her go.
Once you have found her, never let her go.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.